to her left, mutterings of amazement grew ever more pronounced as the government in exile pored over the message, printed on tree bark in homemade ink. "Son of a bitch!" She heard Colonel Milchamp curse. "So that's how they always knew where we were, what we were up to before we even got started." Megan moved closer to the table. "Please summarize, Colonel." Milchamp looked up at her. The portly red-faced militia officer shook several sheets until someone grabbed his arm and pried them out of his hand.
"Optical fibers!" he cried.
Megan shook her head.
"I beg your pardon?" "They doped them. Every string, telephone, cable, communications, pipe, almost every piece of electronics on the planet. They're all tuned to resonate back on a probability band the damn birds can broadcast."
Colonel Milchamp's voice choked on his anger. He swiveled and walked away. Megan's puzzlement must have shown.
"Perhaps I can explain, Madam Coordinator," said John Kiley, a tall man with the sallow complexion of a lifetime spacer. Kiley's peacetime profession was captain of an in-system civilian freighter. His merchant vessel had taken part in the mockery of a space battle, one of the few survivors, if that was the right term. Overpowered, battered, finally reduced to peppering Gubru-fighting planetoids with its comm laser, the wreck of the Esperanza only made it back to Port Helena because the enemy was leisurely in consolidating the Gimelhai system. Its skipper now served as Megan's naval advisor. Kylie's expression was stricken. "Madam Coordinator, do you remember that excellent deal we made, 20 years ago, for a turnkey electronics and photonics factory? It was a state-of-the-art, midget-scale autofac, perfect for a small colony world such as ours." Megan nodded. "Your uncle was coordinator then. I believe your first merchant command was to finalize negotiations and bring the factory home to Garth."
Kylie nodded. He looked crestfallen.
"One of its main products is optical fibers. A few said the bargain we got from the Kwaku was just too good to be true, but who could have imagined they might have something like this in mind, so far in the future, just on the off chance that they might someday want to—"
Megan gasped.
"The Kwaku? They're clients of—" "Of the Gubru," Kylie nodded. "The damn birds must have thought even then that something like this might someday happen."
Megan recalled what Uther Calding had tried to teach her, that the ways of the galactics are long ways, and patient as the planets in their orbits. Someone else cleared his throat. It was Major Pratha Chulthorn, the short, powerfully built Terrigan's Marine officer. He and his small detachment were the only professional soldiers left after the space battle and the hopeless gesture of defiance at the Port Helena spacefield. Milchamp and Kiley held reserve commissions.
"This is most grave, Madam Coordinator," Pratha Chulthorn said. "Optical fibers made at that factory have been incorporated into almost every piece of military and civilian equipment manufactured on the planet. They are integrated into nearly every building. Can we have confidence in your son's findings?"
Megan nearly shrugged, but her politician's instincts stopped her in time.
"How the hell would I know?" she thought. "The boy is a stranger to me."
She glanced at the small Chen, who had nearly died bringing Robert's message to her. She had never imagined Robert could inspire such dedication. Megan wondered if she was jealous. A woman Marine spoke next.
"The report is co-signed by the Timbrimi Athaklena," Lieutenant Lydia McHugh pointed out.
The young officer pursed her lips.
"That's a second source of verification," she suggested.
"With all respect, Lydia,"
Major Pratha Chulthorn replied,
"the Tim is barely more than a child.
She's Ambassador Utha Kalding's daughter, Kylie snapped. And Chim technicians helped perform the experiments as well.
Pratha Chulthorn shook his head.
Then we have no truly qualified witnesses.
Several counselors gasped. The sole neo-chimpanzee member, Dr. Susan Bernishka, blushed and looked down at the table. But Pratha Chulthorn didn't even seem to realize he'd said anything insulting. The major wasn't known to be strong on tact.
Also, he's a Marine,
Megan reminded herself. The Corps was the elite Terrigan's fighting service, with the smallest number of Dolphin and Chim members. For that matter, the Marines recruited mostly males, a last bastion of old-time sexism. Commander Kylie sifted through the rough-cut pages of Robert Onigle's report.
Still, you must agree, Major, the scenario is plausible. It would explain our setbacks and total failure to establish contact, either with the islands or the mainland.
Major Pratha Chulthorn nodded after a moment.
Plausible, yes. Nevertheless, we should perform our own investigations before we commit ourselves to acting as if it is true.
What's the matter, Major? Kylie asked. You don't like the idea of putting down your phase burner rifle and picking up bows and arrows?
Pratha Chulthorn's reply was surprisingly mild.
Not at all, sir, so long as the enemy is similarly equipped. The problem lies in the fact that he is not.
Silence reigned for long moments. No one seemed to have anything to say. The pause ended when Colonel Milchamp returned to the table. He slammed the flat of his hand down.
Either way, what's the point in waiting?
Megan frowned.
What do you mean, Colonel?
Milchamp growled.
I mean, what good do our forces do down here?
He demanded.
We're all going slowly stir-crazy. Meanwhile, at this very moment, Earth herself may be fighting for her life.
There's no such thing as this very moment across interstellar space, Commander Kylie commented. Simultaneity is a myth. The concept is embedded in Anglic and other Earth tongues, but...
Oh, revert the metaphysics,
Milchamp snapped.
What matters is that we can hurt Earth's enemies.
He picked up the tree bark leaves.
Thanks to the gorillas, we know where the Gubru have placed many of their major planet-based yards. No matter what damned library spawn tricks the birds have got up their feathers... They can't prevent us from launching our flicker swivers at them. But we have three hidden away. There weren't any used in the space battle, and the Gubru can't know we have any of them. If those missiles are supposed to be good against the Tandu, damn their seven-chambered hearts, they'll surely suffice for Gubru ground targets.
And what good will that do? Lieutenant McHugh asked mildly.
We can bend a few Gubru beaks. Ambassador Utha Kalding told us that symbols are important in galactic warfare. Right now, they can pretend that we hardly put up a fight at all, but a symbolic strike, one that hurt them, would tell the whole five galaxies that we won't be pushed around.
Megan Onigle pinched the bridge of her nose. She spoke with eyes closed.
I have always found it odd that my Amerindian ancestors' concept of counting coups should have a place in a hyper-technological galaxy.
She looked up.
It may indeed come to that, if we can find no other way to be effective. But you'll recall that Utha Kalding also advised patience.
She shook her head.
Please sit down, Colonel Milchamp. Everybody, I'm determined not to throw our strength away in a gesture, not until I know it's the only thing left to do against the enemy. Remember, nearly every human on the planet is hostage on the islands. Their lives depended on doses of Gubru antidote. And on the mainland there are the poor Chims, for all intents, abandoned, alone.
Around the conference table, the officers sat downcast.
They're frustrated, Megan thought, and I can't blame them.
When war had loomed, when they had begun planning ways to resist an invasion, nobody had ever suggested a contingency like this. Perhaps a people more experienced in the sophistications of the great library, in the arcane art of war that the eons-old galactics knew, might have been better prepared. But the Goober's tactics had made a shambles of their modest defense plans. She had not added her final reason for refusing to sanction a gesture. Humans were notoriously unsophisticated at the game of galactic punctilio. A blow struck for honor might be bungled, instead giving the enemy excuse for even greater horrors. Oh, the irony! If Uther Calding was right, it was a little Earthship halfway across the five galaxies from here that had precipitated the crisis. Earthlings certainly did have a knack for making trouble for themselves. They'd always had that talent. Megan looked up as the small Chen from the mainland, Robert's messenger, approached the table, still wearing his blanket. His dark brown eyes were troubled.
"Yes, Petrie?" she asked.
The Chim bowed.
"Ma'am, the doctor wants me to go to bed now."
She nodded.
"That's fine, Petrie. I'm sure we'll want to debrief you some more later, ask you some more questions. But right now, you should rest."
Petrie nodded.
"Yes'm. Thank you, ma'am. But there was something else, something I'd better tell you while I remember."
"Yes? What is it?" The Chen looked uncomfortable. He glanced at the watching humans and back at Megan.
"It's personal, ma'am. Something Captain Oneagle asked me to memorize and tell you."
Megan smiled.
"Oh, very well. Will you all excuse me for a moment, please?"
She walked with Petrie over to the far end of the room. There she sat down to bring her eyes level with the little Chim.
"Tell me what Robert said."
Petrie nodded. His eyes went unfocused.
"Captain Oneagle said to tell you that the Timbrimi Athaklena is actually doing most of the organizing for the army."
Megan nodded. She had suspected as much. Robert might have found new resources, new depths, but he was not, and never would be, a born leader. Petrie went on.
"Captain Oneagle told me to tell you that it was important that the Timbrimi Athaklena have honorary patron status to our Chims, legally."
Again, Megan nodded.
"Smart. We can vote it and send word back."
But the little Chim shook his head.
Ma'am, we couldn't wait for that, so I'm supposed to tell you that Captain Oneagle and the Timbrimi Athaklena have sealed a consort bond. I think that's what it's called.
His voice trailed off, for Megan had stood up. Slowly, she turned to the wall and rested her forehead against the cool stone.
"That damn fool of a boy,"
part of her cursed.
"It was the only thing they could do,"
another part answered.
"So, now I'm a mother-in-law,"
the most ironic voice added. There would certainly be no grandchildren from this union. That was not what interspecies consort marriages were for. But there were other implications. Behind her, the council debated. Again and again, they turned over the options, coming up dry, as they had for months now.
"Oh, if only Uther Calding had made it here," Megan thought. "We need his experience, his wry wisdom and humor. We could talk like we used to, and maybe he could explain to me these things that make a mother feel so lost."
She confessed to herself that she missed the Timbrimi ambassador.
She missed him more than any of her three husbands, and more even, God help her, than she missed her own strange son. Chapter 51 Uther Calling. It was fascinating to watch Calt play with a Ney squirrel, one of the native animals of these southern plains. He coaxed the small creature closer by holding out ripe nuts in his great, thinning hands. He had been at it for over an hour, while they waited out the hot noonday sun under the cover of a thick cluster of thorny bramble. Uther Calling wondered at the sight. The universe never seemed about to cease surprising him. Even bluff, oblivious, obvious Calt was a perpetual source of amazement. Quivering nervously, the Ney squirrel gathered its courage. It took two more hops toward the huge Thenanin and stretched out its paws. It plucked up one of the nuts. Astonishing! How did Calt do it? Uther Calling rested in the muggy shade. He did not recognize the vegetation here in the uplands overlooking the estuary where his pinnace had come down, but he felt he was growing familiar with the scents, the rhythms, the gently throbbing pain of daily life that surged and flowed through and all around the deceptively quiet glade. His corona brought him touches from tiny predators, now waiting out the hot part of the day, but soon to resume stalking even smaller prey. There were no large animals, of course, but Uther Calling kenned a swarm of ground-hugging insectoids grubbing through the detritus nearby, seeking tidbits for their queen. The tense little Ney squirrel hovered between caution and gluttony as it approached once more to feed from Calt's outstretched hand.
"He should not be able to do that."
Uther Calling wondered why the squirrel trusted the Thenanin, so huge, so intimidating and powerful. Life here on Garth was nervous, paranoid in the wake of the Burrali catastrophe, whose deathly pall still hung over these steppes far east and south of the mountains of Mulun. Calt could not be soothing the creature as a Timbrimi might, by glyph singing to it in gentle tones of empathy. A Thenanin had all the size sense of a stone. But Calt spoke to the creature in his own highly inflected dialect of Galactic. Uther Calling listened.
"Know you, sight, sound, image, and essence of destiny, yours, little one? Carry you, genes, essence, destiny, the fate of star treaders, your descendants?"
The Ney squirrel quivered, cheeks full. The native animal seemed mesmerized as Calt's crest puffed up and deflated, as his breathing slits sighed with every moist exhalation. The Thenanin could not commune with the creature, not as Uther Calling might, and yet the squirrel somehow appeared to sense Calt's love.
"How ironic," Uther Calling thought.
Timbrimi lived their lives awash in the ever-flowing music of life, and yet he did not personally identify with this small animal. It was one of hundreds of millions, after all. Why should he care about this particular individual? Yet Calt loved the creature. Without empathy sense, without any direct being-to-being link, he cherished it entirely in abstract. He loved what the little thing represented, its potential.
"Many humans still claim that one can have empathy without psi," Uther Calling pondered.
"To put one's self into another's shoes," went the ancient metaphor. He had always thought it to be one of their quaint pre-contact ideas, but now he wasn't so certain. Perhaps Earthlings were sort of midway between Thenanin and Timbrimi in this matter of how one empathized with others.
Colt's people passionately believed in uplift, in the potential of diverse life forms eventually to achieve sapiency. The long-lost progenitors of galactic culture had commanded this billions of years ago, and the Thinanin clan took the injunction very seriously. Their uncompromising fanaticism on this issue went beyond being admirable. At times, as during the present galactic turmoil, it made them terribly dangerous. But now, ironically, Uther Kolding was counting on that fanaticism. He hoped to lure it into action of his own design. The Nay Squirrel snatched one last nut from Kolt's open hand and then decided it had enough. With a swish of its fan-shaped tail, it scooted off into the undergrowth. Kolt turned to look at Uther Kolding, his throat slits flapping as he breathed.
"I have studied genome reports gathered by the Earthling ecologists," the Thenanin consul said. "This planet had impressive potential only a few millennia ago. It should never have been ceded to the Burrali. The loss of Garth's higher life forms was a terrible tragedy."
"The Nahali were punished for what their clients did, weren't they?"
Uther Kolding asked, though he already knew the answer.
"Aye, they were reverted to client status and put under foster care to a responsible elder patron clan. My own, in fact. It is a most sad case."
"Why is that?"
"Because the Nahali are actually quite a mature and elegant people. They simply did not understand the nuances required in uplifting pure carnivores, and so failed horribly with their Burrali clients. But the error was not theirs alone. The Galactic Uplift Institute must take part in the blame."
Uther Kolding suppressed a human-style smile. Instead, his corona spiraled out a faint glyph, invisible to Kolt.
"Would good news here on Garth help the Nahali?" he asked.
"Certainly,"
Kolt expressed the equivalent of a shrug with his flapping crest.
"We Thinanin were not in any way associated with the Nahali when the catastrophe occurred, of course, but that changed when they were demoted and given under our guidance. Now, by adoption, my clan shares responsibility for this wounded place. It is why a council was sent here, to make certain the Earthlings do not do even more harm to this sorry world."
"And have they?"
Kolt's eyes closed and opened again.
"Have they what?"
"Have the Earthlings done a bad job here?"
Kolt's crest flapped again.
"No, our peoples may be at war, theirs and mine, but I have found no new grievances here to tally against them. Their ecological management program was exemplary. However, I do plan to file a report concerning the activities of the Guru."
Uther Kolding believed he could interpret bitterness in Kolt's voice inflections. They had already seen signs of the collapse of the environmental recovery effort. 2 days ago, they had passed a reclamation station, now abandoned, its sampling traps and test cages rusting. The gene storage bins had gone rancid after refrigeration failed. An agonized note had been left behind, telling of the choice of a neo-chimpanzee ecology aide who had decided to abandon his post in order to help a sick human colleague. It would be a long journey to the coast for an antidote to the coercion gas. Uther Kolding wondered if they ever made it. Clearly the facility had been thoroughly dosed. The nearest outpost of civilization was very far from here, even by hover car. Obviously, the Gubru were content to leave the station unmanned.
"If this pattern holds, it must be documented," Kolt said. "I am glad you allowed me to persuade you to lead us back toward inhabited regions, so we can collect more data on these crimes."
This time, Uther Kolding did smile at Kolt's choice of words.
"Perhaps we will find something of interest," he agreed.
They resumed their journey when the sun, Gimilhai, had slipped down somewhat from its burning zenith. The plain southeast of the Mulun Range stretched like the undulating wave tops of a gently rolling sea, frozen in place by the solidity of earth. Unlike the Vale of Sindh and the open lands on the other side of the mountains, here there were no signs of plant and animal life forms introduced by Earth's ecologists, only native Garth creatures. And empty niches. Utha Calling felt the sparseness of species types as a gaping emptiness in the aura of this land. The metaphor that came to mind was that of a musical instrument missing half its strings.
Yes, apt, poetically appropriate.
He hoped Athaclena was taking his advice and studying this earthling way of viewing the world. Deep, on the level of Nahakiri, he had dreamt of his daughter last night. Dream picted her with her corona reaching, kenning the threatening, frightening beauty of a visitation by Tutsunukan. Trembling, Utha Calving had awakened against his will, as if instinct had driven him to flee that glyph. Through anything other than Tutsunukan, he might have learned more of Athaclena, of how she fared and what she did. But Tutsunukan only shimmered, the essence of dreadful expectation. From that glimmer he knew only that she still lived, nothing more.
That will have to do for now.
Kalt carried most of their supplies. The big Thenanin walked at an even pace, not too difficult to follow. Utha Calving suppressed body changes that would have made the trek easier for a short while, but cost him in the long run. He settled for a loosening in his gait, a wide flaring of his nostrils, making them flat but broad, to let in more air, yet keep out the ever-present dust. Ahead, a series of small tree-lined hummocks lay by a stream bed, just off their path toward the distant ruddy mountains. Utha Calling checked his compass and wondered if the hills should look familiar. He regretted the loss of his inertial guidance recorder in the crash. If only he could be sure.
There!
He blinked. Had he imagined a faint blue flash?
Called?
The Thenanin lumbered to a stop.
Hmm?
He turned around to face Utha Calling. Did you speak, colleague?
Kalt, I think we should head that way. We can reach those hills in time to make camp and forage before dark.
Hmm. It is somewhat off our path. Kalt puffed for a moment. Very well. I will defer to you in this. Without delay, he bent and began striding toward the three green-topped mounds. It was about an hour before sunset when they arrived by the watercourse and began setting camp. While Kalt erected their camouflaged shelter, Utha Calding tested pulpy, reddish, oblong fruits plucked from the branches of nearby trees. His portable meter declared them nutritious. They had a sweet, tangy taste. The seeds inside, though, were hard, obdurate, obviously evolved to withstand stomach acids, to pass through an animal's digestive system and scatter on the ground with its feces. It was a common adaptation for fruit-bearing trees on many worlds. Probably some large omnivorous creature had once depended on the fruit as a food source and repaid the favor by spreading the seeds far and wide. If it climbed for its meals, it probably had the rudiments of hands. Perhaps it even had potential. The creatures might have someday become pre-sentient, entered into the cycle of uplift, and eventually become a race of sophisticated people. But all that ended with the Burrurali, and not only the large animals died. The tree's fruit now fell too close to the parent. Few embryos could break out of tough seeds that had evolved to be etched away in the stomachs of the missing symbionts. Those saplings that did germinate languished in their parent's shade. There should have been a forest here,
instead of a tiny, scrabbling, woody patch.
"I wonder if this is the place,"
Utha Calling thought. There were so few landmarks out on this rolling plain. He looked around, but there were no more tantalizing flashes of blue. Kalt sat in the entrance of their shelter and whistled low, atonal melodies through his breathing slits. Utha Calling dropped an armload of fruit in front of the Thenanin and wandered down toward the gurgling water. The stream rolled over a bank of semi-clear stones, taking up the reddening hues of twilight. That was where Utha Calling found the artifact. He bent and picked it up, examined it. Native chert, chipped and rubbed, flaked along sharp, glassy-edged lines, dull and round on one side where a hand could find a grip. Utha Calling's corona waved. Lurananu took form again, wafting among his silvery tendrils. The glyph rotated slowly as Utha Calling turned the little stone axe in his hand. He contemplated the primitive tool. The Lurananu regarded Kalt, still whistling to himself higher up the hillside. The glyph tensed and launched itself toward the hulking Thenanin.
"Stone tools, among the hallmarks of presentience," Utha Calling thought.
He had asked Athaclena to watch out for signs, for there were rumors, tales that told of sightings in the wild back country of Garth.
"Utha Calling!"
He swiveled, shifting to hide the artifact behind his back as he faced the big Thenanin.
"Yes, Kalt?"
Kalt
appeared uncertain.
"Mito kan mi betwilifith.
Kalt shook his head. His eyes closed and opened again.
"I wonder if you have tested these fruits for my needs as well as yours?"
Utha Calling sighed.
"What does it take? Do Thenanin have any curiosity at all?"
He let the crude artifact slip out of his hand to drop into the river mud where he had found it.
"Aye, my colleague, they are nutritious, so long as you remember to take your supplements."
He walked back to join his companion for a fireless supper by the growing sparkle of the galaxy's light. Chapter 52. Athaclena. Gorillas dropped over both sharp rims of the narrow canyon, lowering themselves on stripped forest vines. They slipped carefully past smoking crevices where recent explosions had torn the escarpment. Landslides were still a danger. Nevertheless, they hurried. On their way down, they passed through shimmering rainbows. The gorillas' fur glistened under coatings of tiny water droplets. A terrible growling accompanied their descent, echoing from the cliff faces and covering their labored breathing. It had hidden the noise of battle, smothering the bellow of death that had raged here only minutes before. Briefly, the dinsome waterfall had had competition, but not for long. Where its fumescent torrent had formerly fallen to crash upon glistening, smooth stones, it now splattered and spumed against torn metal and polymers. Boulders dislodged from the cliffsides had pounded the new debris at the foot of the falls. Now the water worked it flatter still. Athaclena watched from atop the overlooking bluffs.
"We do not want them to know how we manage this," she said to Benjamin. "The filament we bunched up under the falls was pre-treated to decay. It'll all wash away within a few hours, sir. When the enemy gets a relief party in here, they won't know what ruse we used to trap this bunch."
They watched the gorillas join a party of Chim warriors poking through the wreckage of three Gubru hover tanks. Finally satisfied that all was clear, the Chim slung their crossbows and began pulling out bits of salvage,
directing the gorillas to lift this boulder or that shattered piece of armor plate out of the way. The enemy patrol had come in fast, following the scent of hidden prey. Their instruments told them that someone had taken refuge behind the waterfall, and it was a perfectly logical place for such a hideaway, a barrier hard for their normal detectors to penetrate. Only their special resonance scanners had flared, betraying the Earthlings who had taken technology under there. In order to take those hiding by surprise, the tanks had flown directly up the canyon, covered overhead by swarming battle drones of the highest quality, ready for combat. Only they did not find much of a battle awaiting them. There were, in fact, no Earthlings at all behind the torrent, only bundles of thin spider silk fiber, and a tripwire, and planted all through the cliff sides a few hundred kilos of homemade nitroglycerin. Water spray had cleared away the dust, and swirling eddies had carried off myriad tiny pieces. Still, the greater part of the Gubru strike force lay where it had been when explosions rocked the overhanging walls, filling the sky with a rain of dark, volcanic stone. Athaklena watched a Chim emerge from the wreckage. He hooted and held up a small, deadly Gubru missile. Soon a stream of alien munitions found its way into the packs of the waiting gorillas. The large presentients began climbing out again through the multi-hued spray. Athaklena scanned the narrow streaks of blue sky that could be seen through the forest canopy. In minutes the invader would have its fighters here. The colonial irregulars must be gone by then, or their fate would be the same as the poor Chims who rose last week in the Vale of Sind. A few refugees had made it to the mountains after that debacle. Fibbin Bolger was not one of them. No messenger had come with Galet Jones's promised notes. For lack of information, Athaklena's staff could only guess how long it would take for the Gubru to respond to this latest ambush.
"Pace, Benjamin."
Athaklena glanced meaningfully at her timepiece. Her aide nodded.
"I'll go hurry him up, sir."
He sidled over next to their signaler. The young Chimmy began waving flapping flags. More gorillas and Chims appeared at the cliff edge, scrambling up onto the wet, glistening grass. As the Chim scavengers climbed out of the water-carved chasm, they grinned at Athaklena and hurried off, guiding their larger cousins toward secret paths through the forest. Now she no longer needed to coax and persuade, for Athaklena had become an honorary Earthling. Even those who had earlier resented taking orders from an E.T. now obeyed her quickly, cheerfully. It was ironic. In signing the articles that made them consorts, she and Robert had made it so that they now saw less of each other than ever. She no longer needed his authority as the sole free adult human, so he had set forth to raise havoc of his own elsewhere.
"I wish I had studied such things better," she pondered. She was unsure just what was legally implied by signing such a document before witnesses. Interspecies marriages tended to be more for official convenience than anything else. Partners in a business enterprise might marry, even though they came from totally different genetic lines. A reptiloid bigla might enter into consort with a chitinous Fruthian. One did not expect issue from such joinings, but it was generally expected that the partners appreciate each other's company. She felt funny about the whole thing. In a special sense, she now had a husband, and he was not here.
"So it was for Mathakluana all those long, lonely years," Athaklena thought, fingering the locket that hung from a chain around her throat.
Uthakalding's message thread had joined her mother's in there. Perhaps their Lelactolaptan spirits wound together in there, close as their bond had been in life.
"Perhaps I begin to comprehend something I never understood about them," she wondered.
Sir? Ma'am?
Athaclena blinked and looked up. Benjamin was motioning to her from the trailhead, where one of the ubiquitous vine clusters came together around a small pool of pinkish water. A chimney technician squatted by an opening in the crowded vines, adjusting a delicate instrument. Athaclena approached.
You have word from Robert?
Yes, sir,
the chimney said. I definitely am detecting one of the trace chemicals he took along with him.
Which is it?
She asked tensely. The chimney grinned.
The one with the left-handed adenine spiral. It's the one we agreed would mean victory.
Athaclena breathed a little easier. So, Robert's party, too, had met with success. His group had gone to attack a small enemy observation post north of Lorne Pass and must have engaged the enemy yesterday. Two minor successes in as many days. At this rate, they might wear the Goobru down in, say, a million years or so.
Reply that we also have met our goals.
Benjamin smiled as he handed the signaler a vial of clear fluid, which was poured into the pool. Within hours, the tagged molecules would be detectable many miles away. Tomorrow, probably. Robert's signaler would report her message. The method was slow, but she imagined the Goobru would have absolutely no inkling of it, for a while at least.
They're finished with the salvage, General. We'd better scoot.
She nodded.
Yes, scoot we shall, Benjamin.
In a minute they were running together up the verdant trail toward the pass and home. A little while later, the trees behind them rattled and thunder shook the sky. Clamorous booms pealed, and for a time the waterfall's roar fell away under a raptor's scream of frustrated vengeance.
Too late,
she cast contemptuously at the enemy fighters.
This time.
Chapter 53 Robert. The enemy had started using better drones. This time, the added expense saved them from annihilation. The battered Goobru patrol retreated through dense jungle, blasting a ruined path on all sides for 200 meters. Trees blew apart, and sinuous vines whipped like tortured worms. The hover tanks kept this up until they arrived in an area open enough for heavy lifters to land. There the remaining vehicles circled, facing outward, and kept up nearly continuous fire in all directions. Robert watched as one party of Chims ventured too close with their hand catapults and chemical grenades. They were caught in the exploding trees, cut down in a hail of wooden splinters, torn to shreds in the indiscriminate scything. Robert used hand signals to send the withdraw and disperse order, rippling from squad to squad. No more could be done to this convoy, not with the full force of the Goobru military, no doubt already on its way here. His bodyguards cradled their captured saber rifles and darted into the shadows ahead of him and to the flanks. Robert hated the way the Chims kept this web of protection around him, forbidding him to approach a skirmish site until all was safe. There was no helping it, though. They were right, damn it. Clients were expected to protect their patrons as individuals, and the patron race in turn protected the client race as a species. Athaclena seemed better able to handle this sort of thing. She was from a culture that had come into existence from the start, assuming that this was the way things were. Also, he admitted, she doesn't worry about machismo. One of his problems was that he seldom got to see or touch the enemy, and he so wanted to touch the Goobru.